This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. I'm on holiday this week, and if you don't stop talking about Brexit, I might not come back. I said this week's episode is a recording of an interview I did with Ruth Davidson, the Scottish Conservative leader, at the incredible Signet Library in Edinburgh. It was a special Times Plus event for Times subscribers where we sat down to discuss her new book, Yes, She Can. Of course, we discussed Brexit and Boris Johnson and her ambitions or not to be Prime Minister. But what was also really nice is being able to sit down with a politician and discuss some things other than politics. We talked about her upbringing, her background, her frank admission about her own mental health problems in the past, and how she is preparing for imminent motherhood. But I began by asking her why she decided to write the book in the first place and why she was so keen to stress that it's not a memoir.
After the Brexit referendum debate in Wembley last 2 years ago now, I got lots of nice letters from people that didn't live in Scotland who were unaware that I'd already led the Tory party in Scotland for 5 years and thought I was this new face on the political scene, when actually I was a bit of an old-timer. And one of them came from a publishing company that said, you've got quite interesting things to say. Have you ever thought of writing things outside of politics? Why don't you come down and have a chat? And I thought, well, you know, I've got a fine degree in English literature from Edinburgh University that I've never used in my entire life. Do you know what? How hard can writing a book be? Let's go and find out and ask. Turns out really hard, really, really hard. But I went down and they were asking me, so is there anything that you kind of want to write about? And I said, well, actually, I've got this brilliant idea of doing some inspirational women, chapter by chapter, because this was the Me Too movement had just started. All of this kind of thing was coming on the public consciousness. We were coming up to the 100-year anniversary of the first women in the United Kingdom getting the vote. I said, look, I think there's a moment here, and what I would love to do is just have not me not in it at all, and just have women talking in their own words about it. And they said, yeah, we love that idea, but if we're going to give you any money, you have to be in it. So I was like, all right, okay.
You're not just transcribing what other people have said.
Well, there was a lovely book that I remember reading from Dylan Jones, which was called Cameron on Cameron. Yeah. And he basically followed David Cameron around before he became Prime Minister for several weekends. And he just wrote up things that Cameron had said. He spent like 36 hours at a time with them over several weekends. So he must have, you know, spent quite a long time over the course of a year. And there wasn't a single annotation from the author in it saying, and then he did this, or and then he looked like that. And it flowed really well. And there's a technique to doing that that's quite hard, actually, to do. And that's what I had envisaged. And they said no to that idea. So it ended up being, we compromised on me writing some introductions and doing some stuff of my own thoughts and maybe some of my own background and some of my own experiences. And also these amazing sort of women who have excelled in areas that are either dominated by men, so there's loads more men like science and tech and business and politics, religion, the armed forces, or where women and men get treated hugely differently, like sport, like the entertainment industry, like Hollywood, and like British television. So that was the two ideas. And then when we decided on the kind of areas, that's where we started approaching the women. And there's some fantastic people in there, some of whom you'll have heard of. So people like Catherine Granger that have won, you know, 5 Olympic gold medals, some person called Theresa May, but also people from other countries that you probably won't have heard of. So there's a fantastic Syrian doctor called Rola Halam, who over the last few years has set up 6 children's hospitals during the civil war, and her experiences of trying to get in and out of Syria and to do that sort of thing. And this amazing Indian ninja who has trained more than 10,000 of India's special force soldiers, so their equivalent of the SAS. She does their close quarter battle training and their small arms training. So she's literally the only woman on base when she's, you know, teaching the hardest men in the subcontinent how to kill people. So, I mean, they are fascinating studies, absolutely fascinating women.
And how did you go about coming up with the list? Was it you had one and then was there any connection? Oh,
complete
or?
And total self-indulgence. who do I want to speak to and what do I want to ask them? So, in a sense, it is quite a personal book to me because these are people I am very interested in. But one of the things that I loved about being a journalist and particularly a broadcaster, which I did for 10 years before I put my name on a ballot paper, was I actually loved that responsibility of asking the questions that I thought the people at home wanted to know. And there's some amazing sort of ways in which women have opened up in there, and they all kind of knew that part of it was I wanted to speak to them because they'd done something that nobody else had, and I wanted to talk about that success. But part of it was I also wanted them to open up about how hard it had been, because quite often we seem to think that people who are in the public eye or have won awards or have reached the top have had it really easy, and actually none of these women have. And part of the deal was they also had to tell me about the sort of crying into the pillow in the night sort of stuff. And to be fair to a woman, they all did. And it was, you know, I think it was really brave of them. Some of these stories have never been told before.
You have in the book, there's lots of interesting turns of phrase and very Ruth Davidson turns of phrase. But you had one in particular about the impression that when somebody becomes successful, the impression that they are perfect and all has been fine.
Yeah, I think the phrase I used was, if somebody's famous, it's because they eat sunshine and shit rainbows. I think is probably the phrase.
That was the phrase.
Was that the phrase?
Phrase?
Yeah.
That was the phrase I was going for.
But I think that becomes more and more applicable, and not just for famous people. So for famous people, that's definitely true. So if, you know, you've got an Oscar winner or something like that, you know, their publicist goes to huge sort of trouble to try and make sure that they're always smiling, they're dressed in couture, they're dripping in diamonds, they look perfect all of the time. But even for people who aren't famous, we all cultivate our own social media feeds. We all see, you know, on Facebook, everybody's puts pictures of themselves out having some great time clinking glasses with hundreds of friends. And actually, if you're having a pretty tough time yourself and you just see everybody else is having fun and you're sitting at home in your pajamas having Weetabix for tea, you know, you can feel a bit shitty about yourself. And I think part of it was to demonstrate that even if you're having a tough time now, you know, everybody has tough times, but that doesn't need to stop you. And I think that's quite a hopeful message.
One of the things that really struck me with so many of the stories were quite similar. People who'd gone on to be incredibly successful seem to have quite often lost a parent early on or suffered some trauma or something that happened in their lives which brought them up short, but then gave them either the drive or sometimes the confidence to go off and do things. Was that something that you were conscious of?
I think that women are tough. I think they're resilient. And one of the things that I love about women, and it's not unknown that I love women, is that, just for anyone that wasn't aware, one of the things that I love about women is that they can suffer great hardships without choosing to become hard themselves and can actually use that experience to help other people on the way up. And one of the reasons that these women who had no reason particularly to speak to some wee lassie from Scotland that was writing their first book and they didn't know what it was going to be and was asking them for all their deep, dark secrets, one of the reasons for talking to me was because they wanted to show the next generation how it could be done and to just make it that bit easier and to smooth the path a little bit. And I think, you know, I think that's inherently virtuous.
In the sections of which you did write about you, which you didn't want to, you talked about your own apparently never-ending childhood traumas of you were run over and then... Well, just talk us through it briefly. Just talk us through the three stages of...
Yeah, I have a sort of cavalier disregard for personal safety. I think it's the best way of describing it. So, I got run over by a truck outside my house when I was five. So I spent quite a lot of time in the Sick Children's Hospital, the old Sick Kids just over the meadows there, growing up, and had to do the kind of learning how to walk again. And actually, one of the most traumatic things about that whole period was my parents were asked if it would be okay if I was used as an example for some of the medical students, because they pioneered a new type of leg setting on me, because I broke my leg in several places. I fractured my pelvis, my femoral artery was crushed, so I've got a massive kind of scar all the way down here, and had my cano sets sticking outside of me and stuff. And when you're five, like, it's absolutely terrifying to be sort of pushed in front of an amphitheatre of, you know, 300 people, kind of going up into the sky and then whipping the covers off and somebody like lectures about you for an hour. So, I mean, genuinely, like, as in quite howling, like, this is really quite upsetting.
This is quite tame by comparison.
Yeah, oh yeah, so, brilliant. You know, public speaking, they always tell you to imagine the audience naked, but, you know, when it's the audience looking at you and you're there for an hour and it's chilly and you're only five, it can be not much fun. But, so the kind of being the only kid in my primary school with a Zimmer frame, having to learn how to walk again. And when you're a kid, you don't really understand, so you just want to be as good as your pals at stuff. So learning how to climb trees and play football and all that sort of stuff. And I think, looking back, the most remarkable thing is my parents, actually, because if that was me and my child had had a really difficult experience, I think I would have wanted to wrap them up in cotton wool. And they let me do all of the things that I could do, and let me sort of join the local boys' football team. And it is actually probably my proudest moment that I'm the first girl to play for Largo under-14s boys' football club. you know, nothing in my life. Like, that's the high point. I've peaked at 12. What's that?
Were you the last as well?
No, I think there was one other girl.
Oh, okay,
certainly in my kind of generation when I was still living in Fife. So there was one other girl. So that was one. And then about 20 years after that, I'd be about 25, about 20 years after that, I was in the Territorial Army and I jumped head first through a window frame on command and landed badly in some sort of sandpit in the snow, which was like concrete, and broke my back in three places, and ended up in Salisbury General Hospital. So every time the Skripal poisoning comes on the television, I go, oh, that was my ward. Yeah. So I was in there for a bit and then got discharged with a back brace, which I had to wear for 3 months and stuff like that. So, yeah. Like I say, I'm quite clumsy, but I'm very enthusiastic. Yeah, very enthusiastic.
You talked about, in the Sunday Times, you talked about your experience when you were at university. And I think everyone who read it would have been struck by your honesty about the mental health problems that you had. What, just explain, if people didn't read it, what happened? But also, I'm just quite interested in what it's like putting it out there so publicly.
Yeah, I mean, I came to university at 17. I went to Edinburgh Uni, and I think, although you couldn't have told me that at the time, I would have ripped your head off if you'd said it at the time. I think I was too young, probably, to go. And I really struggled. I'd come from Buckhaven High School, just a few sort of dozen miles away, where there was 330 pupils started. We had a really big cohort in my first year, and there was only 90 still there by 6 year because people left at 16, 17. So not that many people from my school went on to university. I was the first generation of my family, me and my sister, to go to uni. And when I got to Edinburgh, I was really struck by the fact there were so many folk that weren't like me. So loads of people that were from, like, the home counties and had done a gap year in Borneo tending to orangutans, or in Tanzania building orphanages. And,
you know, they were all... Those people are the worst.
Well, they were, and you know, they're, like, lovely people, but they were all, like, 20, 21. They'd all done A-levels, whereas I'd done Scottish Highers. They had the most amazing bulletproof confidence. They all wore, like, puffer jackets and gilets and drove Volkswagen Golfs, and, like, they all knew each
they
other.
Really the
and, like, it's the first time in my life I'd ever been asked what school I'd gone to, because it didn't mean anything to me. Do you know, like, it was properly just different, and I really kind of struggled. And doing an arts degree, you know, it's massive lecture theatres, nobody cares if you turn up or not, there's no structured time, anything like that, and I got properly lost. And then, you know, it so I had all of that sort of stuff going on, and then a friend from back home had committed suicide, and he had also been run down on the same stretch of road that I had a couple of years after me. And it's the oddest thing, because we weren't really close. He was the year above my sister at school. His dad used to was a teacher of mine, and he'd lived across the road from me since I was five. So I knew him. We had loads of pals in common, but we weren't, like, he wasn't one of my best mates or anything like that. And for whatever reason, that was just this massive trigger for me to just kind of completely have a bit of a meltdown. And I was diagnosed with clinical depression, and I think we've learned a lot in the last 22 years. At that time, I'm not sure the treatment I was given was brilliant. So it was just like, here's some pills, off you go, come back. Things are still really terrible. Actually, they're worse. Right, let's just double your dose, off you go. And it was pretty tough. But you kind of get through things and you kind of work your way through things. But it wasn't an easy time.
And how did it feel bringing this out into the public, writing about it in the book, when you're sort of sitting there and you think, well, I'm going to tackle this, knowing that it's going to go out in the world and people who see you as being this confident, gregarious. This, you know, your big personality who comes across as very confident and gregarious, and to open yourself up in that vulnerability, lots of people wouldn't have done it, and for entirely understandable reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have wanted to do it for a while. I've kind of felt compelled to do it for a while. About 2-3 years ago, I was speaking with one of the really big mental health charities in Scotland, Sam H, who are in and out of the Parliament all the time. We do loads of work with them, and I had done lots of work with them, and I had said, you know, I want to do this, but I want to kind of do it in a way that I feel like I own it, and I don't really want to do it with a newspaper, because they'll interpret it and it'll, you know, I don't know, I won't then be able to control it. So actually, when the book came along, it was, in a sense, a way in which I could. And it's a really odd thing to kind of explain, but it did feel a little bit like a compulsion, because I think if, you know, I've been in this job for quite a while now, about 7 years, and both the defeats and the victories are on the board. You know, people can see for themselves that, if nothing else, by God, I've lasted. You know, and in Scottish politics, that isn't always true. It's a pretty robust sport, Scottish politics. But I think if I ever walked off the stage many years from now, I hope, after having achieved a few more things, and I'd never, ever let anybody know, I would feel like I had sort of failed people, because it would have made such a difference to me when I was 18 to have heard anyone talk about this. And nobody did back then. I mean, we're talking more than 20 years ago now. And just to know that it wasn't a full stop, because I really did think that all of the hopes and dreams that I had for myself probably weren't going to happen because this I had this thing. And it's not like that. And I think the way that we still talk about mental health, it's got so much better, and the stigma is so much further removed. But one of the issues that I have is we quite often talk about it as if either it's a full stop, and it's not, or we talk about it as if, well, I had it once and now I'm cured. And it's kind of not like that either. So I was wanting to try and make the point that you know, you can manage this, and you can just keep tabs on yourself, and you actually probably end up knowing yourself better once you've kind of gone through this and are able to make decisions about your own health and the things that you do, and the way in which you can make choices in your life in a much more informed way, and that it's not a full stop, you know. And I just hope, I mean, even if, you know, it's quite a high stakes thing to do, I'm not sure that, you know, every headline that's been written since I was delighted with, and, you know, certainly my Twitter feed has been a pretty messy business for the last wee while. I think I would have been disappointed in myself if I'd never told people.
One of the things that you talked about, because there is not an interview that goes by where you're not asked, do you want to be Prime Minister?
Oh, God, I know, it's so boring, isn't it?
Are you going? So I'm not going to ask you.
Because not, you gave... not this time, Matt.
No,
you've done it
yet.
Every other interview
exactly,
you've ever given me.
Yeah. And you still gave the story to the Sunday Times. Now, but in the interview in the Sunday Times, you talked again about why you didn't want to do it. And one of the reasons you gave was because you were concerned about that. You'd seen up close David Cameron and Theresa May, the pressure of doing that job.
Well, do you know what's really interesting? I've been saying that for 2 years, because I've been being asked this question for about 2 years, and it's all David Cameron's fault, because he was asked who could be a possible successor, and he happened to be in Scotland at the time, so he said me to be kind. And just to be a polite visitor and a nice guest, you know. apparently he was raised well, that boy, I don't know. It's kind of dogged me since then, and it's all his fault. But I've been saying that for a really long time. You know, I value my relationship, I value my family, I value my mental health. And I've also tried to demonstrate the practical things in that, you know, I would at some point have to try and leave the Scottish Parliament, which I've not attempted to do in 2 years. I would have to, you know, want to up sticks and find a seat, which I've had no intention of doing. You know, I've literally been saying no for 2 years. You know, I sound like the Dr. Ian Paisley. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's been a lot of saying no's. And for whatever reason, nobody believed me until this. And I think, actually, that's quite interesting, because it shows that we do still need to have a conversation about mental health. If nobody believed all of these other things that ruled me out, why do they believe this? And that's a conversation that we do need to have.
Some of the reaction to it has been, some of it was incredibly positive, and people, you know, a lot of people praised you for being so honest. But there were some people who said that by conflating having a history of mental health problems with ruling yourself out of doing a big job,
but I'm not.
Would in some way put
I've got
people
a big
off.
Job I want to do, and it's right here in Edinburgh. You know, it's at Bute House.
Now, there were other people who said that. But there were some people who said that you, by saying that your mental health history in some way ruled you out of being Prime Minister, but not of being First Minister, suggested it might be you were implying that First Minister wasn't as big a job.
No, I don't think I was. What I was saying is that I don't want to build my home, my family, have my children here, and then spend my working week 450 miles away from things that are more important to me than personal ambition. And my family is more important to me than personal ambition. And I don't think that's an odd thing. I think lots of people make decisions what is right for them. You know, I live 3.5 miles from Bute House. I am the MSP for Bute House. I want to be the MSP in Bute House. You know, it's like, you know, and Scotland is my home. You know, I am of this place, and I am intensely ambitious for my country, and I am intensely ambitious for my party, and I'm intensely ambitious for what we can do in politics in Scotland if we're not squabbling about the constitution all the bloody time. And I think that, you know, I don't see a contradiction in that whatsoever, in saying that, you know, I'm incredibly privileged and I get to see behind the door at number 10 Downing Street, and I don't want it. What I want is here, and that's where my life is, and that's where my family is, and that's where my future is.
So let's talk about your family and your imminent departure from the front line. The thing that really struck me in the book, because it's something you keep on saying, is that you can't just take a break. You can't have a rest. You're constantly doing things. I know people who work for you say that you're...
I'm totally hyperactive.
You're basically a bit of a nightmare. And so how do you think...
And have been since I was a kid.
How do you think you're going to... Because it will be a shift in gear. How are you preparing for motherhood?
Well, it's going to be one of two things. Either I'm going to walk away and have a child and, you know, make sure the stitches heal and all that sort of thing, and then come back several months later and, you know, have completely morphed into some sort of Earth Mother in during that time. Or I'm probably going to be on the phone 3 times a day, every day, going, why are you doing it like that? To the office. So it could work out either way, and I don't know. But I think the supposition that I'm going to find it very hard to be away from the office is based on the fact that I might not be overwhelmed by all of the things that you have to do with a newborn. And I have seen my sister's got 4, and I've kind of seen it up close, and I think I might be quite busy while I'm away. I'm not having a 4-month holiday, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's it might be a break from the office, but it's not going to be a break.
How do you think the party will cope, be different? Because you have been this sort of one-woman force almost, which has transformed the fortunes of the Conservative Party in Scotland.
That's not actually true, but I love it when people say that.
Well, it was part of the agreement for you coming.
Right, okay. But no, I mean, we've been building a really good, strong team here. And yeah, I'm the front man because the leaders are always the front men. But no, we've got some
front
real
woman.
Talent. Front women.
Don't be sexist, come on.
Sorry. Yes, you can. but no, I mean, we've been building a really strong team. And my deputy, Jackson Carlisle, that's taken over, has been my deputy for the last 7 years. God love him for putting up with me. But, you know, he's going to be grand. He's going to be super. And, you know, we have built a bus team around what we do in Parliament, how we hold the SNP to account when we're down in Westminster. The new MPs have been in for more than a year now, so they've found their feet, they know what they're doing. I'm fairly confident. I mean, I used to work in radio, and the way in which presenters, so DJs and things in commercial radio, they were always desperate that the person that depped for them when they went on holiday and deputised for them was good enough that they didn't lose any listeners, but not so good that they got replaced. So I'm kind of feeling that sort of trepidation. So I want Jackson to be good, but not that good. So I do still want a job to come back to, yeah, if that's all right. So yeah, so that's my kind of concern. It's making sure that both of these things happen.
I feel like sort of duty bound. In fact, one of the things, while you are off, we are going to cross another one of Nicola Sturgeon's deadlines for updating us on her thinking for when she might or might not ask for a second referendum. But she, she said it would be in October this year. What do you think will happen? Where do you feel like the debate is?
Well, I think it's been made pretty clear that the make or break decision on Brexit and a deal between the UK and the EU is going to happen at the summit in October. And if there is enough progress there, there will be a kind of signing off, sort of dotting the I's, crossing the T's, heads of terms agreement in November. So I think realistically the kind of October update from the First Minister will move to November, because that's when things are going to happen. But, you know, she's been trailing this for months and months and months, and the polls have not moved. You know, we are still where we were. There is no overwhelming kind of uprising looking for independence. And I think actually there's a weariness from people across Scotland to actually focus on things that matter day to day in terms of public services and the performance of schools in Scotland, where we know we can do better in terms of the economy. So I think, you know, irrespective of some kind of street rallies that have happened around the country in the last few months, I don't see a huge groundswell, and pollsters and everyone else doesn't see it either. So I think there might be a fudge that's brought forward by the First Minister. But, you know, it's up to her. She can ask, and I can continue to say no. And, you know, we've been dancing that dance for a long time. I danced it with her predecessor. We can keep going. So,
Did you ask her to take part in the book?
I didn't, no, although she is in it. So she's quoted in it from a response to a New Statesman front cover.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't do a sit-down interview with her. We only kind of took one representative from each kind of discipline, really. And the Prime Minister said yes, so... if she said no, I could have thought of someone else. But, but she very kindly said yes to me.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
While we're on the Prime Minister, are you worried about how all this is panning out?
I think anyone that says they know exactly what's going to happen is probably... lying through their teeth. But you know, when, like I say, I was a journalist for more than 10 years before I was a politician, and at the BBC we covered any number of European negotiations on any number of issues, and they all sort of followed the same pattern, which was quite a lot of brinkmanship, quite a lot of people saying no before they said yes, then lots of people at the sort of final hour locking themselves in a room to a hard deadline, the deadline passing at midnight, and then at 4 a.m. the next morning, you know, people bleary-eyed coming out of there to say that actually they'd found some compromise in the end. I mean, my view through all of this is that it is in everybody's interests, both the United Kingdom's and in the EU's, to make sure that there is a deal. I still believe that to be the case. I still believe that there's political will on both sides. And we saw in some of the ameliorating statements from Donald Tusk that... Well, I mean, it's funny, because yesterday he was saying that Chequers was a big step forward, today he's saying it's not going to happen, but we've got this other big meeting that's going to happen next month and we think we can get there by then. People have to talk to their home audiences as well as talk to each other in the room. There's an awful lot of people who have elections coming up in the near future and have populist right parties or populist left parties who are talking to their home audiences as well, looking tough before kind of getting to the deal. And I expected people to negotiate hard. This is a big geopolitical issue. You know, of course, it's concerning that we are still in a place where it is not clear to everybody exactly what's going to happen and when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. But I still think that there will be a deal.
Do you still think that whatever the deal is, it won't be as good as the benefits of having stayed in the EU?
Well, I'm a big fan of wider unions. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. I like Scotland staying in the United Kingdom. I would have liked the United Kingdom to stay in the EU. I think that working in close cooperation with friends and allies and neighbours gives you benefits beyond pounds and pence. And I think that one of the big challenges post-Brexit is to ensure that people understand the United Kingdom still wants to carry its burden in the world and is still a good friend and neighbour and will still contribute in all of these other ways, even if we're not part of this particular political union. You know, it's sad for me. Nobody is in any doubt where I stood during the Remain campaign. I was, you know, on the stage bellowing away as best I could down in Wembley. But I'm also a Democrat and I can't sit here in Scotland and watch somebody like Nicola Sturgeon say, you know, vote in an independence referendum, it'll last for a generation, lads, and then a week past Tuesday afterwards saying, no, let's do it all again, just because we didn't like the answer, and say, you don't get to keep rerunning the question until you get the answer that you like, and then say that just because I've had an answer in a different referendum that wasn't what I wanted, that we had to disregard the views of 17 and a half million people. So don't get it wrong, this has been a hard couple of years for me in terms of politics and conflict of what I'm passionate about, what I believe in and what I want to see happen. But my role in this, I think, has been, or how I've seen it, is to best make sure that we people have the right, certainly people from Scotland and businesses and sectors, are able to speak to the negotiating team, to speak to ministers down south that are in the room so that they can explain what works for them, where they see opportunities, where they see risks, how we can mitigate those risks, how we can maximise those opportunities, and how we can do this in the best way, even if it's not what I wanted and still not what I would choose. So it has been a time of great conflict for me and for lots of people in politics. But I have to say, in the last 7 years, I've fought 6 national elections and 2 referenda. And the thing about elections is everybody understands what happens and who they can vote for and they know that they can change their mind and all the rest of it. The things about referenda is they push people into binary camps and that pushes people into tribes. And quite often, the division and the dispute comes after. So the answer never actually resolves the question. And I would happily never fight a binary constitutional referendum again in my lifetime because I think it's poison politics in this country. And you've got to a stage now where, for some, they will only listen to your ideas on education or on health or whatever if you're already in their tribe. That sort of balkanisation or Ulsterification or whatever you want to call it in politics. And I think that's a shame because good ideas are good ideas no matter where they come from. And we're seeing all around the world the extremes getting louder and the centre getting quieter. And I think that's bad for politics everywhere. I really do. Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk about the Prime Minister's future and whether she having secured a deal, hopefully before Christmas, and then we leave the EU in March. There are, from all sides of certainly the Tory party in Westminster, people saying, well, maybe then that's the time that you should pass on to a new generation. Is that the right time? Would you support that?
Do you know, I would really quite like some of my colleagues in Westminster just to shut up for a bit and just put their sharp elbows and their personal ambition away and just let the Prime Minister do her job and go into bat for the country and bring home a deal. That's what I wish more than anything for the next few weeks and months, genuinely, is it's absolutely right that people have had their say about what sort of Brexit they want, how they want to input and all the rest of it. But we're right down to crunch time now. We're talking weeks, not months. We are sending the Prime Minister in to negotiate, sitting across the table from 27 other nations and the massed ranks of the institutions of the EU, and we're asking her to bring something back for the country. I don't care what you want your next job to be. Your job now is to get behind her and let her deliver for the country. Let the woman do her job. That's where I'm standing at the moment.
And given the progress that you've made in Scotland, both in Holyrood and in last year's general election, where you very much bucked the Conservative trend, what would happen to the Conservative Party in Scotland if Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg became Prime Minister?
Well, I think it's incumbent on all leaders to be able to show that they can govern for the whole of the United Kingdom, and I'm not going to be drawn on your question because I was not born yesterday.
Always worth a go, though.
I think our Prime Minister is, you know, whatever, you know, whether you're a Tory, not a Tory, whether you are a Theresa May fan, not a Theresa May fan, I think there will be a lot of people that look back on this period and recognise just how much resilience that she has shown. And that, I mean, this is a tough job. I mean, I, you know, really, really tough. And there are days that I've spoken to her at, you know, 7 a.m. or 10 o'clock at night or whatever. And if I had had the sort of day that she had had, either the day before or during that day, you know, I think it would be hard to get me out from under the duvet. And I am hyperactive. And her personal, her individual tenacity, her personal resilience of just keeping plugging away. Particularly, I mean, she never talks about being a type 1 diabetic. She never talks about now being sort of over 60 or any of that sort of stuff. But the resilience that she's showing under the most extreme pressure that, you know, we haven't seen in politics since the financial crash in 2008 and before then for a couple of decades before that is genuinely remarkable and astonishing. She is just doughty in that, I don't know, is that an English word? Do you know doughty? Scottish word?
Yeah, doughty.
Yeah, she's just,
we do use the same language.
Well, no, but but you don't
but not
say,
all of them. You've got a few funny
but you
ones.
Don't, you don't say things like smur and herpal and dreek and stuff like that.
So well, that's the weather.
I mean, she is a genuinely doughty soul and all of the kind of clichés that are spoken about her, about being about service and duty and responsibility and all of that. They sound like clichés because everybody says it, but everybody says it who knows her because they know it is true. And she genuinely wants to deliver. And I do think that we might look back on this period and slightly marvel at just how many punches she took and just kept getting back off the canvas in order to try and get a deal for the country.
That's sort of a round of applause. I just want to go back to the book. It is a great read, and you can tell that you're a journalist because you know how to sort of rattle through a tale or two.
But it's quite easy to dip in and out of. Like, it's a funny book. You'll see it's a kind of odd structure. So there's bits that are just women, like a little individual scene from their life or something that's happened to them that's in a chapter just by itself where it's supposed to be seeing behind the curtain so you feel like you know the person, as well as interspersed through it, there is their opinions about some of the really big issues that are facing women in the world today. So they're eminently qualified to talk about the issues, but I also really wanted people to see, feel like they felt like they knew them a little bit. So it was designed for sort of women on the tube or on the shuttle down or on the bus on the way to work, so you can dip in and out of it. So it's not a really hard textual read. It's supposed to be quite accessible. And hopefully people feel that they can dip in and out of it a little bit. So it was designed to be like that, although it is quite an odd structure, so bear with it. You'll get used to it, honestly.
My only complaint about it is the title. Because I think, actually, a lot of it applies as much to men as women.
And yeah, but you guys have had stuff written for you for years. Give us this one.
No, but because I think a lot of what the lack of confidence, the worry that everyone else is doing well and you're not, yeah. and all of that. I didn't just read it because we were meeting.
Yeah, you did. You were contractually obliged to.
I could have not read it. I've done these things before without reading them.
Well, that's true. I don't doubt that.
But I think, and one of the things that really struck me is that, and I totally get why you've written the book, and as I've got two daughters, and the message in it is totally the message I'd want them to have. But one of the things that really struck me, you talked about how when you first became the Scottish Tory leader, and it was a huge deal for the Tory party, particularly in Scotland, that somebody who'd basically been in politics for 5 minutes, a woman who was gay, becoming the leader of the Conservative Party in Scotland was a huge deal. And you said that you got far more letters from young gay men seeing you as a role model. And so the idea that your role is just about being a role model for women, I think it probably goes further than that.
Well, I mean, I kind of, as I say in there, like, I'd never actually believed in role modelling before, just because I'm the sort of person that's a bit cussed, and if you tell me I can't do something, that means that I'm going to do it just to show you that you're wrong. That's just kind of, I'm just a pain in the arse that way, to be honest with you. Sort of, if kind of for context, going back to 2011, we'd had another bad election after about 20 years of stagnation and decline. We got about 12.5% of the votes. I was the only new MSP for the Tory party that got elected, and that was only because someone retired, so it was kind of dead men's shoes. My predecessor, Annabel Goldie, is a bit of a heroine of mine, and, you know, she resigned on my first day in Parliament. You know, so it wasn't great. And then we had this leadership election, where literally I'd come from nowhere and had been asked to stand, and I didn't particularly want to because I wanted to learn my sort of trade on the back benches for a bit, but felt that I was compelled to. And it didn't occur to me, like genuinely didn't occur to me, that anybody outside the three people in the Collie Dog who were the Conservative Party membership in Scotland at the time would care who the Scottish Conservative leader was. And I was really surprised that I got quite a lot of correspondence and lots of emails. Almost all of them started, "I'm not a Tory but," which, you know, back then started quite a lot of correspondence. But it was folk that were saying, "Look, I'm out of school, but I'm not out to my parents," or, "I've always thought that I could do politics, or I was interested in it, but I never thought that I could do it because I'm gay." And, you know, and this is 2011. This isn't like 1896, you know. And it really struck me that it mattered to other people that, not that I had got this job, but that somebody like me had got this job. And I sort of promised myself that I would never not answer the question if people asked me about my sexuality. I would never sort of try and pretend it didn't exist or anything like that, despite the fact there was a huge risk that I would then just get known as the gay politician because nobody knew anything about me. I'd come from nowhere. And I had lots of other things I wanted to talk about, lots of things to say. As you can tell, I talk a lot, at length, very fast. Yeah, I mean, it really, really struck me that it sometimes matters, that seeing somebody like you can help you. And hopefully, in my best Presbyterianism, there was a sense of, no, I'm going to go out and smash this role that I have no idea how to do, and half of my backbenchers didn't want me in it in the first place, and most of Scotland doesn't really care about the Tory party, and the rest of them hate us. My first view was, just don't be shit. Just please, Davidson, don't be shit, because I just don't want to embarrass other gay people. Yes, there's loads of things I want to achieve. I want to play my full part in the referendum. I want to pick the party back up off the canvas. I want to be able to have a debate in Scotland, a political debate that's genuinely left versus right, that we can get that idea and the contest of ideas back, because we hadn't had it for years in Scotland, with the soggy left consensus. You know, there was loads of things I wanted to achieve, but overwhelmingly my reaction to those emails were, please God, just don't let me be shit at this.
I think don't be shit would have been a good title for the book.
Yeah, now, yeah, could have been. Yeah.
Inspirational message for everyone. Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure, Ruth. The book is tremendous. I know you're going to enjoy it, but just the best of luck over the next few weeks. We look forward to all your tweets, watching Homes Under the Hammer and whatever it is that you're going to be doing.
Oh, please no. Please no.
But no, the very best of luck. Please do once again thank Ruth Davidson.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.